Hello and welcome to Adam and Eve, your feminist radio show on CJSR 88.5 FM and around the world at cjsr.com. My name is Marco Visconti and I will be your host for this evening. On the first half of this week's show, women take center stage. Christine Socamo Frederick is one of the most active women in the arts scene in Edmonton. Among the many roles she fulfills, Christine Frederick is the executive director of the Dream Speakers Film Festival and the artistic director of the Rubaboo Festival. Now, she will be instrumental in opening an exciting opportunity for Indigenous artists in the cultural heart of the city. Fellow Adam and Ever Marie Fontaine met with Christine Socamo Frederick in her office at the Dream Speakers Festival Society to chat about becoming the Citadel Theatre's first Indigenous associate artist. Let's take a listen.
This city has been going through a transformation for several years. I think a lot of our cornerstone organizations, arts organizations, have felt that momentum. And I'm really excited and very pleased to announce that the Citadel Theatre, one of Alberta's most prestigious theatre companies, has, I guess, in one way of saying it, busted open a door by making the very first appointment for an Indigenous associate artist.
So who was the person who decided to bust that door down?
The brand new artistic director, Daryl Cloran. He came off of doing artistic directorship in Kamloops and working with Indigenous artists while he was there. This gentleman, Daryl Cloran, has such an incredible philosophy, and I'm really excited by the things that he's bringing into the Citadel in the meetings that I've had with him so far, and really realizing that a lot of both his philosophies and what he's bringing in and my philosophies are really in alignment. They're quite kismet, so I'm really excited.
Tell us about your background as an artist.
My grandmother, Christine Daniels, was a leader in bringing Indigenous culture into the city in an urban context. And she had started in the 70s it was the White Braid Society. And it was one of the first times that Aboriginal youth had an opportunity to explore their culture through powwow, through drumming, dancing, singing, regalia making, beading, and all of the teachings were infused with cultural aspects and tenets of our culture. And so I started off as a powwow dancer when I was very young. And one of the things that she always strove for was opportunities for young Aboriginal people to represent their culture. So we had many opportunities, you know, on Canada Day and on special arrival of dignitaries and things like that, where we would be called out by the city to dance and to welcome people to our territory. So I spent my childhood dancing at Fort Edmonton Park and every summer, always there. But also, you know, White Braid danced for the Queen when she was here and things like that. And then because I enjoyed it and had that sort of idea of presence in performance, I started getting involved in film and television as a child performer as well. So I was in a couple of commercials and TV things and movies, some feature films. At the time, my mother was a television producer. And then when I went into high school, just fell in love with theater. Absolutely fell in love with theater. I often say Shakespeare saved my education. And, you know, while I was at Victoria School here in Edmonton, a fine and performing arts high school, we started, myself and my little friends, my gang of friends, we started the Shakespeare Club and the Shakespeare Festival. And by the time we graduated, it was an all school, all departments, large festival with a great big feast at the end. And I think at the time the principal was really keen on that. And that kind of got both myself and some of, you know, the people that I hung around with into the idea of starting a theater company when we finished high school. So we did have a Shakespearean theater company called Sound and Fury Theater, and both acted in plays, but also served on the board of directors and as the president for a while. And always looking to expand into more film roles, more TV roles. Got an agent when I was 18 and did those things. But I also When I was a little bit later after university, I had the opportunity to work in my culture again. My grandmother had come back from BC, and she had been asked by all of those youth from the 70s who are now adults and having kids of their own. She was asked to start up another powwow troop, which she did, called White Buffalo Society. And I actually quit my job so that I could spend more time working within my culture and working with her. And it was such an incredible time being a program coordinator there and bringing powwow drummers and dancers around the world to perform, but and also to represent both Canada, but also Indigenous culture here on this Turtle Island. So I brought a troupe to Korea in 2004, and it was incredible. It was an international folklore festival. It was a really fantastic opportunity, not only for myself, but for the youth that I brought and some of the more senior dancers and drummers as well. And then it was 2009, Workshop West Playwrights Theatre started a new festival called Rubaboo. And they put a call out. I think the former AD there, Michael Clark, he realized that he had a privilege, had the infrastructure of an organization that could apply for grants, and he knew that there wasn't a lot going on for Indigenous performers in Edmonton at that time. So he applied for the funds, he started the festival, but he brought on a whole bunch of Indigenous coordinators and performing artists to coordinate the festival. And that first one, it was called the Rubaboo Arts Festival. And it was just like a two-night affair with some readings of plays intermixed with a couple of musical performances. And then he was really clear he wanted Indigenous people to take it over. And so myself and Ryan Cunningham, we partnered and we started Alberta Aboriginal Performing Arts Association, and we took over the Rubaboo Festival. And that very first year, we expanded it to 4 days, and we included other disciplines of art. We also immediately partnered with the Dream Speakers Film Festival Society, which was at the time fantastic because we had access to all these performers and entertainers, but we didn't have any venues, whereas Dream Speakers was producing their festival. They had venues, but no performers. So it worked out really well to initiate that kind of a partnership, and I'm really excited and proud that these many years later, we have a formal partnership agreement for the next 2 years to work together and do as much as we can for both the Indigenous arts community here in Edmonton and in Alberta, but also, you know, the overall arts community. I think we have a lot to offer this whole community within Edmonton and within Alberta. And one of the things that we've been working on too is really nurturing the international relationships we have with other Indigenous groups and with other artists across Canada. You know, I was talking to a friend of mine because of this recent appointment and more media attention, and she looked at, there's a video online of a Red Talk that I gave. It's like TED Talk, but it's an Indigenous, so
okay,
Red Talk.
Red Talk.
And I talked about my journey through art. I guess back in 2011, I was quoted in a newspaper of talking about art, and I said, you know, it's really incredible that we have people like our ancestors, members of my own family, who really pushed the political needs for Indigenous people so that we could leave the reserve, we could gain the right to vote, we could gain the right to earn more money than 25 cents, and reduce, and in some ways eradicate, the criminality of our culture, which is, a lot of people are not aware that it was, in fact, our culture was criminalized in this country. And so I've learned a lot from working with people, I've learned a lot from exploring both locally and internationally what Indigenous culture means. And I made the mistake once of saying that I had the luxury of being an artist because of those people who fought for our rights. When I came back from a trip to Costa Rica where I was learning about Indigenous rights, and I read that article, I was ashamed of myself. I realized it, I mean, it's not that I had drastically disconnected from community, but I think I didn't understand at that point really what art was. I had an appreciation of it. But when I went to Costa Rica, when I learned about what it's like to not be identified as a Native person, as an Indigenous person. When I was over there, people thought I was white. Hmm. I've never had that experience. And so it was very awkward for me and sad even. But the moment I picked up a rattle and started singing an Indigenous song, the local Indigenous people immediately saw me as an Indigenous person. And that was the moment of relation. Right. And it ended up being one of my most favorite days of my entire life to be recognized, to have other people see me as someone that they could relate to. They understand. They had questions about, you know, what was the song I was singing? What did it mean? What is my Indigenous language? They wanted to know about my background. And it was just so wonderful. It opened the door. Mm. So art has that capacity to not only allow us to have an identity when maybe our skin doesn't show it, when our own personal histories aren't there, you know, a part of the local history, when you're out there in the world, how powerful it is to have someone recognize that you're their sister.
But also to see that as something to strive for, as mm-hmm. opposed to hide away from.
Exactly. Immediately valuable. And beyond that, you know, I realized that when I came back that art was not a luxury and it's not a privilege. It's a responsibility, because if I hadn't learned that song, if I hadn't known something about my Indigenous culture, I would have been invisible to them and I would have been invisible to myself.
Welcome back to Adam and Eve on CJSR. My name is Marco Visconti. On this week's show, we're highlighting some recent accomplishments of women in the arts here in the Edmonton area. We just finished listening to an interview produced by Adam and Eve reporter Marie Fontaine with Christine Sakemo Frederick, who was recently named the Citadel Theatre's first Indigenous Associate Artist, and she will be working as a liaison between the Citadel and Edmonton's Indigenous community. Marie also connected with the Maggie Tree, an Edmonton-based theater company that strives to support the development and visibility of women in creative leadership roles. The Maggie Tree is the co-creation of Vanessa Sabarin and Christy Hansen, who launched the company in 2007. Vanessa and Christy saw a need for a dynamic platform which would put more women in the limelight. Their latest production, Nine Parts of Desire, is a play written by Heather Raffo that details the lives of nine Iraqi women during the First and Second Gulf Wars. Marie Fontaine joined the multicultural cast at the Queen Alexandra School during one of their rehearsals. She spoke with Vanessa Sabarin, the director, Ainsley Hilliard, the choreographer, and a few of the members of the cast who took time during their lunch break to chat about their roles. Let's take a listen.
We were looking for something sort of simple to do, and it was a one-woman show, so we looked at it again, and it was just so relevant. The content was just so relevant in terms of all of what was happening this summer with ISIL and with the refugees and all of the conversation that happens with refugees, and then with a particular person running for president and all of the divisive dialogue that we were starting to hear, it just really resonated with us. And also all of the issues that our Indigenous people are trying to work through and that continue to be an issue and really should no longer be an issue. I feel quite firmly about that. It was just so relevant. So we were like, okay, well, let's do this one. But let's do it instead of a one-person show, because it was like, well, who do we cast and how does that... They have to be able to play all of these characters and... Okay, so let's break it into three parts. The playwright, Heather Raffo, had said you can do this as a one-person play, you can do it as a three-person play, you could do it as a nine-person play as well if you want. So we set up an audition and we had a lot of submissions. And we learned a lot about the play through the audition process. And then we decided, well, Christy was like, let's do nine. And I was like, oh, that's a great idea. Which meant then we were casting nine. And then we hired some Iraqi consultants so that we could make sure that our cultural understanding was much deeper, and that it was part of us doing this project was an opportunity to get to know another culture, to say, like, I want to know you, especially if you're living here with us. Like, I want to know more about you. And then we hired an Iraqi artist to visual artist to display in the lobby, which is something we've done as the Maggie Tree, sort of tried to incorporate the lobby in terms of the whole experience of coming to the theater. And we hired two musicians, and we have been, so it just keeps growing, and the more people that we involve, the more information comes into the piece, and the more we see about the piece, and I love the show because it just keeps going, like the depth of it, and the importance of it, and the personal intersections just keep revealing themselves. So it's a play, the play is about, you know, a war and women in war, but it's actually, when you get past that first layer, it's about survival and it's about love. I personally feel that in the world as we are living in right now, it is imperative that we love, and we love now. So this piece is a container for that message, or that, not message, because message is always so insulting to the audience sometimes, but that offer or that invitation or that question, how can we love, story, but also what engages the audience is often a question. Mm-hmm. And it's not like I know something that, or we know something that the audience doesn't know. That's not true. But I have thought a lot about certain questions that this play brings up, and the question of the nature of how we can love, and how we can love in a world as complex as the one we are in now, and how can we know each other better, and how can we stop thinking about us and them and start thinking about us.
So my name's Ainsley Hilliard, and I'm the choreographer or movement kind of designer for this project. Well, I come from a dance background, so in the same ways that the director is directing how the actors are saying things and what their intention is, I'm doing a very similar thing with movement. So shaping the environment that they're in, as well as embellishing their intentions or their emotional feelings with movement, either as a group or individually.
So you obviously have to have some sort of a vision. For
definitely, or you.
And how is that? How does that vision informed?
For me, obviously in reading of the script. But for my practice, I really like to, you know, obviously have some ideas and concepts before I come into the room. But for me, it works best when my vision is based on who is in the room. I always like to go with what's available to me in the room in terms of the people that I'm working with, and their characteristics and personalities actually become a huge inspiration for the type of movement work that I do, and using them as kind of like a catalyst for our movement exploration.
My name is Allison Wells. I've been working professionally in the theater for 50 years. I basically am semi-retired. But when my friend Vanessa called me, because it was her, because I respect her, and because I've always respected the Maggie Tree, I read the script and I thought, ooh, kind of heavy for an old lady. But I thought, I think it's an important play, and I think I would really regret it if I didn't do it. And I said, as long as I don't have to learn too many words, I'll come. So here I am.
I'm Nicole St. Martin, and I got involved because I applied to the Maggie Tree Productions. I'm fairly new to Edmonton, and I'd heard great things about these two, these two being Vanessa and Christy. Wow, this interesting choice of play, and especially given what's going on in the world right now. So I thought I'd audition, and I went in, auditioned, and I had a good chat with the two of them, and felt like it was going to be approached with a great deal of integrity. And I loved how Vanessa was playing with me in the audition. So, I'm at that stage right now where I'm just enjoying this incredible bunch of people that I get to work with. I feel really privileged to be able to work with these people.
My name's Nimet Kanji, and I play Amal in the show. and she's a very interesting character. She's the one that talks the least about the war. I think it's also how people sometimes adapt to their situation in the world that they live in. I actually was born and raised in Nairobi, and I remember growing up with racism, fear, so I can sort of bring some of that into Amal, in terms of unrest in a country. She's very spirited, though, very, very independent. And for her, it's about these relationships where she's trying to find peace for her heart and yet really wanting the freedom of the West.
My name is Amina Shihab. I came to Canada in the beginning of 2013 from Syria. I come not direct from Syria, from Qatar, but I'm Syrian. And when the war started, I came here. And I'm playing Layal. Layal, she's one of the main characters. Layal is not any typical woman, but she's a woman in the war, which we are seeing. Since you are a woman and you live in the war, there is no west or east or north or south. You suffer, you hurt. And Layal is, she's strong. She's a dreamer. She loves everyone. She loves every woman. She always said, it's not just me, it's all of us.
That was an interview with the cast and crew behind the Maggie Tree's upcoming production of Nine Parts of Desire, a play about nine Iraqi women surviving during the First and Second Gulf Wars. The production starts on April 6th at the Varscona Theater. To learn more about the play, visit themaggietree.com. My name is Marco Visconti, and you are tuned into Adamant Eve, your feminist radio show on CJSR. A few days ago, a women's studies course being offered at a rural elementary school in the town of Clyde, Alberta, came to light. Now, while women's studies at a university level generally involves critically analyzing the social, political, and economic treatment of women in society and throughout time, and attempting to dissolve gender essentialist notions such as fixed gender roles, this women's studies was a little bit different. It was discovered that the version of women's studies being taught at Eleanor Hall School in Clyde, Alberta, actually was about hairstyles, dinner parties, recipes, and interior decor. In a description of the course on the Pembina Hills Public Schools website, it says the outcomes of the course are to teach girls how to, and I quote, analyze the shape of their faces to determine which hairstyle is most flattering, assess their body shape to choose clothing styles that are the most complementary, and to complete an online shopping activity to identify their own personal style. While representatives from the local school board have said the course is actually about helping young girls confront harmful notions that they are bombarded with in the media, others see this course as an outdated and oppressive approach to girls' education and a step back for gender equality in the province. I decided to get somewhat of an insider opinion on this issue.
When you brought it up, you're like, did you hear about that school in Clyde that's teaching women's studies? And I was like, what? They're teaching women's studies? That's amazing. And you were like, no.
That's my friend Rachel Carr. Rachel is a school teacher from Edson, Alberta. While she's removed from the situation in Clyde, I thought since she's a teacher in rural Alberta, she might have some insights into this topic.
I didn't like that they attached it to, like, oh, we're giving them an introduction to cosmetology and aesthetics and...
And media studies.
Food and media studies. And I was like, no, you're not. You're teaching them how to do their hair and you're attaching it to their self-esteem and their self-worth in a way that is really detrimental to them and will be for probably a long time. Mm-hmm. And you're not even acknowledging that... I don't know, that, like, a mistake was made.
Were you surprised at all? Does it surprise you when you hear these stories coming out of rural Alberta?
Yeah, I was quite surprised because, like, when we talked about it the first time, I was like, well, maybe they don't have, like, as many or as much access to resources than cities do, city schools. But I think it's more so just kind of I don't want to say negligence, but being kind of willfully blind to what's actually going on and not doing everything that they could be in order to inform themselves on these issues. And just the concept of women's studies, like, the course does not follow what modern women's studies is at all.
No, not at all. It's just like encouraging young girls that their purpose is to learn about beauty.
Exactly. And then in one of the articles as well, I think the superintendent was quoted as saying, like, the purpose of this is to help them navigate adolescence and help them with their self-image and their self-esteem and to make them more self-aware. And I was really taken aback by that. I was like, teenage girls do not need to be made more self-aware. They are probably the most self-aware demographic that we have in schools. They are so self-conscious. They are such a vulnerable population that teaching them that what they're doing isn't right because they don't feel good, so you have to change in order to look like this, or just that your self-worth is based on your appearance and your aesthetic, and that's just not accurate at all. I am more than, you know, my body. I am more than my hairstyle. And to be teaching them that that's how to make themselves feel good is so, so wrong. Like, I try to really not, I guess, encourage the underlying, I don't even know, patriarchy, I guess, which is like, I don't even think about it until I realize that I'm doing it, like choosing the boys first or choosing the boys to go and move something instead of choosing the girls. And since I've kind of realized that last year, I've been purposely like, I need 4 strong girls. I need 4 boys who are able to help, you know, with younger kids, or, and just kind of, I don't know, trying to swap those gender roles a little bit because they're open to it, but it's just a lot of the opportunity isn't there for them. So
that's so interesting. It's so automatic too, in a way, because I can think of when I was in school, like the teacher, if there's something needed to be moved, it was always like, I need 3 strong boys to help me move this table. And you just think, yeah, of course. And then when you're older, you just, because that's the model of teaching you've been given, it just comes out of your mouth, I bet.
Yeah. And I just find myself, like, I'm really disappointed in myself when I do things like that, because I'm like, I know better. I know better than that. And I need to be more direct with myself in being like, oh, never mind, sorry, I need girls instead. Or just picking 4 volunteers and picking the first 4 volunteers instead of necessarily classifying them as, I need 4 boys, I need 4 girls, or whatever.
Mm-hmm. In your experience, do you know who decides what gets taught in a rural classroom?
It really depends on the school board that you work for and how their admin operates. So in my school, our admin gives us a lot of freedom. Mm. And so if I was kind of planning to do something a little more controversial, or, you know, even read a book that might not be on like an approved list, I would just go and ask. And generally they're like, okay, what's your reason for doing this? And we have kind of a discussion about it. But I do know some young teachers who their admin is like, nope, you can't do that. So it's kind of hard. But I would say for the most part, schools are fairly progressive that way.
Yeah.
So even in rural Alberta, and this is a very disappointing example.
Welcome back to Adam and Eve on CJSR. My name is Marco Visconti. That was my friend Rachel Carr we were listening to. Rachel is a teacher from Edson, Alberta, and she was discussing the problematic new women's studies course being offered at a rural elementary school in Clyde, Alberta, that actually focuses more on giving beauty tips to young girls. And that's it for today's show. Thank you so much for tuning in. Adam and Eve will be back with more feminist programming in 2 weeks' time, so make sure to tune in again. If you'd like to follow us on social media, feel free to look up Adam and Eve on Facebook and Twitter, and you can find our past episodes on iTunes and on CJSR's SoundCloud page. Adam and Eve is a spoken word project of CJSR FM 88.5, and our journalism is funded by you, the listeners. We produce this week's show at the CJSR studios at the University of Alberta, located on Treaty 6 territory in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada.